Good morning and happy Sabbath to each of you. It's good to be back here to see you again. For those of you who have not met me before, I'm Luke, and I'm actually a hospice chaplain here in the Valley. I've been here for about the last 3.5 years, and I always look forward to coming back here and spending a Sabbath morning with each of you. I want to tell you this morning about this couple. This is Peter and Lisa Marshall. They got married a little later in life. They had known each other for many years, but they actually didn't get married until they were a bit older, in 2009. They had what they described as a fairy tale marriage. But not long after they got married in 2009, Lisa started to notice things about Peter. He would initially, it started with simple things like forgetting where his keys were, forgetting where his wallet was. That's not too unusual. We all do that. But he would start to forget names, and especially important names, names that he should remember. Eventually, she noticed that he would have a difficult time even putting sentences together. He would stumble over his words a lot and wouldn't be able to finish sentences. And for a while, she didn't really tell anyone. In fact, she wrote about it later. She said, "It was my little secret to ignore," until friends and family members started making comments too. And then I knew it was something real. People who hadn't seen Peter in a while, she writes, immediately noticed something was wrong. Well, they went to the doctor, they had some tests done, and in April 30 of 2018, 9 years after they got married, Peter was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease at the age of 53. Peter began forgetting more and more until eventually he forgot that Lisa was his wife. The first time she realized this, they were coming home from a trip to the beach. And as they were nearing their neighborhood, Peter started talking to her as if she were a stranger, saying, "Okay, so you're going to go down 2 lights and then you're going to make a right." And when they got to the house, she describes this in kind of a funny way. He eagerly got out of his side of the car and came around and opened up her door and kind of walked her nervously into the house and started showing her around their house, her own house, showing her, "This is the living room, this is the dining room." And she knew that he didn't know who she was anymore. It was in and out for a while, but it got worse. She said, speaking of this experience, "It was adorable, but I kept waiting for him to snap back into reality, but he never did." Alzheimer's became Peter and Lisa's new normal. I hear that phrase a lot in my line of work because every day I'm introduced to people, to families who tell us this is our new normal. They got a diagnosis. They were told there is no cure. You just have to learn to make the most of the time you have left. And families struggle with this new normal. That phrase is not a happy phrase. It's not a phrase that we use to describe nice changes in our lives. It's a phrase that's been around for a long time. It actually was first used after World War I when news commentators were describing the way the world would be now that we've had such a war. This is the new normal. We started to hear the phrase again after 9/11. We're living in a new normal. And of course, we've been hearing it a lot these days, haven't we, with the pandemic and the changes that we've experienced as a society. We don't look forward to new normals. A new normal is when we find ourselves in a place we didn't ask to be in, but we know deep down inside that there's really no going back to the way things were. There's no going back to what we might have viewed as the good old days. And so we have to adjust. It's a difficult place to be. It's hard to find ourselves in those new normals, isn't it? Ezekiel, the prophet, was very familiar with being in a new normal that he didn't want to be in. Ezekiel, of course, was one of the exiles who was taken from his homeland and implanted into a new place. And he talks about his new normal in his book, in his prophetic book. And if you have your Bibles with you, or if you have a device that you like to use, I'd encourage you to open to Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 1. If you find yourselves this morning in a new normal, or maybe if you have been living in a new normal for a while now, it is my prayer this morning that Ezekiel's testimony would bring you some hope and encouragement. In Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 1, Ezekiel starts off his book fairly similar to the way other prophets start off their books. He says, in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day, while I was among the exiles by the Kebar River, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. At first read, it seems like any other prophetic book, Isaiah, Jeremiah. Prophets would often start their books by establishing a historical context. So they usually give us a year. They usually tell us which king was in power. But if we read this a little closer, we find that this actually isn't typical for prophetic writing. If we read it closer, we have to ask the question, in the 30th year of what? Of whom? He doesn't say that this is the 30th year of a king. In fact, the king that he refers to is Jehoiakim, and he refers to this being the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's exile, which, by the way, we know when he was exiled, and so if we just add 5 years to that, we find out that this actually takes place, or at least this event that Ezekiel is writing about takes place in about 593 BC. So he does establish a historical context, but what about this 30th year that he's talking about? Maybe he's talking about the previous exile, because Ezekiel was actually a part of the second exile, the second group of people that was taken to Babylon. Ezekiel was a part of a much larger group, about 10,000 people who were taken to Babylon and were actually placed in a neighborhood or a ghetto of sorts where they would live in this foreign land. But there was another exile, the exile that we read about in the book of Daniel, where Nebuchadnezzar first came and took siege of Jerusalem and took more noble people and tried to re-indoctrinate them. But we know when that was too, because whenever Nebuchadnezzar would do something, it was very carefully documented historically. And we know that that date was 605 BC when Daniel was taken. So that's only 12 years earlier This wouldn't be the 30th year of Daniel's exile. It's not the 30th year of King Jehoiakim's exile. It's not the 30th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Maybe he's referring to Jehoiakim's time as king. Maybe Jehoiakim had been king for 25 years leading up to this exile, and he's been in exile for 5 years. But if we look at 2 Kings chapter 24, verse 8, we find that Jehoiakim, who was only 18 years old when he became king, only reigned for 3 months before he was taken into exile. So we're left with that question, in the 30th year of what? In the 30th year of whom? And the most probable explanation is that Ezekiel is referring to his 30th year. In fact, a lot of Bible translations go ahead and just spell this out for us. In the Amplified Bible, it says, "Now it came about in my 30th year." In the Message Bible, it says, "When I was 30 years of age." The NIV also says, "In my 30th year." And the NLT says, "On July 31 of my 30th year." But then that raises another question, doesn't it? Who cares? I mean, you seem like a nice guy, Ezekiel, but this is a historical document. This is a prophetic book. What does your age have to do with anything? Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 2 does give us a bit of a clue as to why his age is important to us. Actually, verse 3, I should say. When Ezekiel says the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, by the Kebar River in the land of the Babylonians. Now it starts to make sense why this year is important to Ezekiel. And maybe the story he's about to tell us, maybe it's not significant for all of Israel, although it is. But maybe he wants us to see on a personal level how important the vision he's about to see is to him. You see, as a priest, or at least as someone who was raised in a priestly family, a part of the Levite tribe, when he turned 30, he would begin service in the temple. Numbers chapter 4, verse 3, verse 23, verse 30, all of these tell us that priests would serve in the temple from the age of 30 until the age of 50, and then they would retire. That'd be nice if we could retire at 50, wouldn't it? So it starts to make sense why this year, why this 30th year is so important to Ezekiel. Because this year, his 30th year, is the year he has been waiting for since he could remember. I'm sure his father would tell him stories about his time in the temple, his time serving in the holy place, changing out the bread of the presence, keeping the candelabra lit, keeping the incense rising up to heaven. I bet Ezekiel's heart would burn within him as he would hear those stories, as he would hear about how close his father would get to the presence of God. And that's not something to take lightly, because the Bible does tell us that God's tangible presence was in the most holy place. This was the year, Ezekiel's 30th year, this was his opportunity to be closer to God, to his tangible presence, than almost any other human had ever come. Can you imagine? Can you imagine the opportunity to minister at the altar of incense, knowing that God's tangible, visible presence is just on the other side of a curtain? This was a big deal to the Israelites, to the Jewish people, and this would have been a big deal to Ezekiel. God made a promise back before they ever built the temple in Jerusalem. God said in Exodus chapter 29, verses 44 and 45, God promises and he says, I will consecrate the tent of meeting, which would later become the temple, and I will consecrate Aaron and his sons, Ezekiel being a descendant of Aaron, to serve me as priests, and then I will dwell among the Israelites and be their God. In the Israelites' thinking, in Old Testament theology, God's presence was very much linked to the temple and to the service of the priests in that temple. It was a big deal. And of course, later, when they finally selected the place, God promised again, then to the place the Lord your God will choose as a dwelling for his name, there you are to bring everything I command you, your burnt offerings and sacrifices, your tithes and special gifts, and all the choice possessions you have vowed to the Lord. This would be not only where God's physical presence would dwell, but this is where God would call people to him to bring their offerings, to worship him. A calendar, an annual calendar, was set up around trips, journeys to Jerusalem to be close to God. And when the temple that Ezekiel knew was finally built, God showed that community that he was physically there. We're told after Solomon finished praying a prayer of dedication for that temple, fire, visible fire, came down from heaven in front of all the people, and it consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. This was a major event for God's people. This was a story that people would tell their children and their grandchildren and their children's children and so on and so forth, reminding them that that building that you see over there, that's no ordinary building. God is there. The closer you came to that building, the closer you came to God. This is why Daniel prayed in the direction of Jerusalem. Because in his mind, according to his theology, that's where God was. He physically was in the most holy place of the temple. In fact, this was such a big deal to Ezekiel and his people that even thousands of years later, they are still fighting over that geographical location. God dwelled in the promised land, in Jerusalem, in the temple, and in the most holy place of that temple. And Ezekiel was one of the chosen few who would stand just feet away from that Shekinah glory. And he could have had that experience this year, his 30th year. The only problem was he was 1,500 miles away from the most holy place of the temple. And there was no chance that he'd be going back anytime soon. He knew that. Three times in three verses, Ezekiel reminds us that he is in exile, that he is not home, that he is not in Jerusalem. In fact, just the fact that he mentions that he is by the Kebar River, one of the rivers near Babylon, it evokes imagery. Psalm chapter 137, verse 1 says, "By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion." This was Ezekiel's experience. That's probably what he was doing down by the river that day. As he was thinking about what could have been, he was praying a prayer of lamentation, I imagine. Why did it have to happen now? Why did it have to happen in my generation of all generations? And when terrible things happen in our lives or in the society that we live in, sometimes it's tempting to ask that question, isn't it? Why now? Why in my generation? But it was in that new normal, at perhaps the lowest point in Ezekiel's life, at perhaps the darkest moment in Ezekiel's life, far away from home, away from the land, away from the people he knew and loved, away from his purpose and his calling and his identity in life, all a thing of the past. It was in that moment that he would encounter God. And his life would never be the same again. In Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 4, Ezekiel continues and he says, "I looked and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light." Now, Ezekiel spends much of this chapter describing this vision, and it's a lot. This is just a screenshot of a Google image search I did of Ezekiel's vision. And let me just tell you, there's some pretty psychedelic, weird stuff that artists have come up with to try and capture what exactly Ezekiel saw, because it was a lot. This is a pretty wild vision. There are some pretty wild visions in Revelation as well, but Ezekiel and his visions certainly take the cake. I mean, he was seeing people with human bodies, but animal-like heads and wings and eyes all over them, and wheels and things floating and hovering. It's a lot, but we're not going to get into the weeds of this vision this morning, because of all the crazy stuff that Ezekiel saw in this vision, there was really one thing that God wanted Ezekiel to know, and that's toward the end of the chapter. In the end of the vision, Ezekiel tells us in verse 26, "Above the vault, above their heads," them being the four living creatures, "was what looked like a throne of lapis lazuli, a beautiful blue throne, apparently, and high above on the throne was a figure like that of a man." And just so that we're certain as to who this figure was sitting on the throne, just a couple of verses later in verse 28, the second part of that verse, Ezekiel states clearly, "This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell face down, and I heard the voice of one speaking." God is sitting on his throne. Not an unusual thing for a prophet to see. What was unusual about this vision of God was that the throne of God was moving. It had wheels. and wings and was being carried to Ezekiel and to the exiles in Babylon. It's hard for us today as Christians, thousands of years later, to really grasp how much of a paradigm-shifting vision this must have been for Ezekiel. Up until this point, God physically dwelled at a very specific location in the most holy place of the temple in Jerusalem, in the promised land on earth. If you wanted to be close to God, you needed to be close to that building. But now, Ezekiel is given a vision in his darkest hour that completely shatters his understanding of God and God's throne room. God can move. God can meet us where we are. As wild as this vision was, it taught one very simple truth. God cannot be bound. He cannot be bound to a building. He cannot be bound to a city. He cannot be bound to a people. He cannot be bound to the past. And he is not bound to the way things used to be or the way things have always been done. God cannot be bound. Did God instruct Moses to build a sanctuary? Yes. Did God instruct the Israelites to travel from far and near to come to that sanctuary to offer their sacrifices and offerings? Yes. Did God's tangible presence dwell in the most holy place of the sanctuary? Yes. But would that be true forever? No. God is doing a new thing, and Ezekiel is the first to hear about it. Ezekiel was longing to go back to the way things were, to what was familiar to him. But God was coming to where he is right now. In fact, if Ezekiel had figured out a way to get back to the temple, he would have been sorely disappointed. Because we find out later in Ezekiel chapter 10, we have another vision Ezekiel's given. This time, God's throne is shown in the most holy place, but it lifts up, it ascends, it leaves the temple, and it heads to the east, where God's people are. God was no longer there. God was no longer where Ezekiel expected him to be. God was coming to his people. And in chapter 36 of Ezekiel, God makes a promise that would become the foundation of the new covenant. Ezekiel chapter 36, verse 27, God makes this promise to Ezekiel and to all of us. I will put my spirit near you. No. I will put my spirit in you. In you. And I will move you to follow my decrees and to be careful to keep my laws. God is no longer up there or over there. God is not some ultra-transcendent being who can only be accessed by jumping through hoops or traveling to a foreign land. God's presence, God's Spirit, is now closer than we ever could have imagined, certainly closer than Ezekiel ever could have imagined. Paul tells us, Do you know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you received from God? God is nearer to us than we ever could have imagined. At his lowest point, Ezekiel was devastated by his new normal. Because according to his theology, God couldn't really fit into his new normal. He was desperate to get back, to go back to Jerusalem. And because he couldn't, he no longer had a sense of purpose. He no longer had a sense of identity. He felt further away from God than he had ever felt. But it was when he felt furthest from God that he actually was nearest to God. That is good news. About 3 years had passed since Peter's diagnosis. He no longer remembered that Lisa was his wife, but he knew that he liked her. He knew that he enjoyed being around her and doing things with her. That much was certain. And on one particular night, they were watching a television show, and this particular episode had a beautiful wedding scene. And Lisa, watching this, reminded of her own wedding that was short-lived before the diagnosis, started to cry. And Peter noticed her crying, and he started laughing. She was used to this by now, by the way, young men. If your wife ever starts crying, yeah, laughing is probably not the best response. But she was used to this behavior by now. She didn't take it personally. She wasn't offended. But she did ask him what he was laughing at. And he said, with a big childish grin on his face, "Let's do it." And she said, "Do what?" And he pointed at the TV screen. And he said, "That. Let's get married. I know it's going to take a lot of planning, and it's probably going to be really expensive, but let's do it. Let's get married. I love you. And I think you love me, right?" Later on, when she was telling this story, she said, "It was so touching to me. He fell in love with me twice." Well, they talked to their families about it, and the families encouraged them, "Absolutely, let's do this, let's make it happen, whatever it takes." And while she was hesitant at first, she agreed, and they set their wedding date for April 26, 2001. And on that day, Peter and Lisa Marshall got married again. Peter's vows were very simple. The ceremony was conducted by a dementia specialist. His vows were simply, "Lisa, I love you." But there was one point in that ceremony. While the two were at the altar, in what seemed like a rare moment of lucidity, where Peter, at least for a moment, remembered who he was and who Lisa was and realized what was happening. And he leaned over to her and whispered in her ear, "Thank you for staying." Some of you may be living in a new normal today, a new normal that you never asked for. You might feel far from God today. You certainly feel far from what is familiar. But Ezekiel's testimony encourages us when we find ourselves in a place where it seems like God doesn't hear us anymore, or he's too far away, or things are just too chaotic or too confusing. Ezekiel reminds us to look around and find what new thing God is doing in our lives. He encourages us to fall in love with God all over again. And most of all, to remember that God never left us. In fact, He's closer now than we ever could have imagined. Amen.